wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's Giannata's sunglasses. Oh, I wish there's Giannata's sunglasses. If he's not his sunglasses, then I'd show you messages hiding before your very eyes.
Good morning and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour for June 8th, 2020 on KBOO Portland. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle, bringing you a socially distanced and coronavirus-free episode recorded last week, all about the recent uprisings against police violence and white supremacy. On today's show, Bill Resnick talks with Black rights and revolutionary socialist activist Malik Mia. Joe Clement talks with writer, filmmaker, and expert on fascism Shane Burley. And Norm Diamond brings us a reflection on how all of this is helping to make another world possible. You can find the links to today's show and its segments at our show page on the KBOO website, along with more information about segments. It usually takes a day or two after broadcast for us to post all of that. But if you subscribe to our show, the links will be delivered to you when they're ready. Visit the Old Mole Variety Hour page at kboo.fm to subscribe, as well as to find links to follow us on Facebook and Twitter, or to contact us with questions, comments, or suggestions. While you're there, click the red donate button in the upper right corner to support your grassroots community radio station. We start today with an interview pre-recorded when only one of the four police killers of George Floyd had been arrested. Bill Resnick talks with Malik Mia, a longtime Black rights and revolutionary socialist activist, a former aviation mechanic, and a contributing editor with Against the Current.
Hi, Malik Mia. Welcome to KBOO.
Thank you, Bill. I'm glad to be here.
Malik Mia is a longtime Black rights revolutionary socialist activist, a contributing editor to the journal Against the Current, the U.S. Socialist Feminist Magazine, Anti-Racist Magazine. He's on the editorial advisory board of Link's International Journal of Socialist Renewal. He's published several pieces recently in Green Left Weekly, one on the deaths of Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, George Floyd, and thousands more Black Americans. Malik Mia will address an online forum on June 7th at 2 p.m. Australian Eastern Time, though, is that right?
So it's actually 8 o'clock Saturday night Pacific time.
8 o'clock Saturday night Pacific time. Okay, and the topic is Black Lives Matter and Mass Revolt in the United States. So Malik Mia will be discussing the uprising, what need be done to stop police violence, also on the politics of it, in particular Trump's invocation of the Insurrection Act, and also how we can prepare for what will happen if sometime down the road the killers are returned to their police forces and the vigilantes are acquitted. That's not impossible. First, Malik Mia, how do you understand the uprising?
Well, let me just say, the uprising that we're seeing around the country was not imaginable even two weeks ago in this country. Most people were under quarantine or stay-at-home shelters, which is a huge pandemic that is not over, COVID-19. We had 30 million people unemployed. The economy is very bad, especially if you're African-American or Latino or Native people. So suddenly, with this police killing and the way it happened on video, it sparked something that, you know, I haven't seen since the late 1960s. And in some ways, this is bigger than the 60s because in a matter of days, we've had protests in over 300 cities in all 50 states. All 50 states. That means Alaska. That means Wyoming. It doesn't just mean the old urban centers, you know, L.A., San Francisco, New York, Boston, Philadelphia, or Chicago. That tells you how deep-seated the anger is, not just about racism, but about other issues. When Trump invoked, or he said he would invoke, the 1807 Act a couple days ago, the next day in D.C., in Chicago, in San Francisco, and even in my little town up in Northern California, wine country, there were demonstrations, big demonstrations. So it tells you that this is something new. The ruling class is going to have a hard time stopping it, and it's a very positive sign for the future.
Yeah, the triggers were, of course, the recent killings of Taylor, Arbery, and Floyd. But it goes a long way back. There are many, many roots, it seems to me. Maybe we should just mention those to begin with. I think our audience probably has heard it before, but...
I mean, I go just the recent, you know, you go back to Trayvon Martin 8 years ago in Florida, which is where the starting point of the Black Lives Matter movement began. And then all those killings, Tamar Rice, the 12-year-old in Cleveland, Sandra Bland, the young woman, and was killed in Texas. And then you get to the recent ones, which were only notified. People didn't even know about what happened in Louisville, Kentucky, with Breonna Taylor, because it was sort of just in the local news. But then after Arbery was killed by the white vigilantes in Georgia, that case got national. And then you get to George Floyd. So for black people, it's deja vu all over again. This stuff happens all the time. And protests began. What's new about the situation today is that it began as blacks protesting and quickly began to get support from other ethnic groups, especially whites. And that's what, to me, is the most significant. You have a multiracial coalition spreading and building up in every city, protesting and demanding justice for Floyd and these other people. That's what is new. That's very significant. And it's not just a black revolt. It's becoming a broader citizens' revolt. Where it will go, time will tell. But I can tell you this, if they do not arrest the other three cops in Minneapolis, besides Chauvin, the guy who had his knee on Floyd's neck, these protests will not stop. So they're going to have to arrest all three and four, and then the question of prosecution. And if it's like Rodney King, if people remember 30 years ago, you know, they finally prosecuted the four cops, and they got acquitted, which led to protests. And that was the last time the 1807 Act was used, actually, was the Rodney King situation. But
right.
It was the governor of California who invited the president to bring in the army forces to deal with the uprising. And that's a strange thing about the 1807 Act. It's really up to the governors to decide if they need that help. But Trump has already said he would do it on his own, whether they gave him support or not, which is not legal, but we don't know what that means.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Malik Mia. He's a... activist, writer, longtime revolutionary socialist. We've discussed so far the roots of the uprising, and in fact, what's so interesting about it is they keep growing, particularly as Trump makes his incendiary remarks, there's a response to it. But what's really interesting is, as Malik discussed, white people are in fact entering these struggles. White people are part of the protest, a major part of the protest indeed. How do you understand that, Malik? It seems to me, as you pointed out, sort of profoundly important, and it's beyond racism now. It seems to me it could be seen as a general protest about the conditions of American life now.
Well, yes, I think that's an important point, because if you look at these big protests are starting in the morning in almost every city, afternoon. How can tens of thousands of people on a normal workday be out on the streets? Because millions of people don't have jobs. So you have people, white and black, brown, out on the streets every day, for hours, because they're suffering unemployment, and they're wearing masks, most of them, because of the COVID-19, and they're on the streets. So there's a certain unity there, understanding the three issues right now: health, unemployment, and racism, which is super racism, because blacks suffer more from health issues like COVID-19. 2-3 times more get the disease. 2-3 times more in every city die, if you're black, from the disease. Native Americans even higher. So you have the three issues combining, and I think that's what's mobilizing not just the African-American community, but the whites and other people as well. That's what you always hope for, but you don't always see, and we've already seen that unity. So this is very significant, very significant. It's hard to underestimate the power of that kind of unity.
Yeah. One thing we haven't discussed, Malik, it's not the killings. It's partly, of course, the killings that concentrates the understanding and creates the sense of injustice even more strongly. but it's the daily humiliations that black people and poor people face in this country, especially when the police are arresting them and challenging them on the streets and asserting their power.
Yeah, well, I think part of what we've seen is that when black people have always tried to explain that whites get treated differently, some people call it white skin advantage or privilege. Some people may understand that the role of white supremacy and the history of this country. Most whites, they don't experience that. So a lot of them, younger white, don't understand it. This is finally waking up a lot of people. Why is the treatment different? Why is it when you sit in a car, like it just happened in Atlanta two nights ago, where these two young college students were in the car and the police broke their window and tried to drag them out? That happens all the time. Okay, you know, when you walk down the street in a neighborhood you don't know about, and if you're black, you have to look over your shoulder and you have to be careful. White people don't do that. This protest and this movement is starting to wake up a lot of whites to that reality. I just make one story. I noticed on one of the demonstrations, maybe it was in Colorado, maybe New York, that a lot of the whites would stand between the African Americans and the police where they had their banners. Now, that's a, you know, that was showed an understanding that if they were all black in front of the cops with their batons and guns, they would be more likely to be hit. The whites in between were saying, as a form of solidarity, you know, you got to go through us.
Yeah.
And I was impressed by that because it shows some consciousness that you know there is a difference. Like the bird guy in Central Park, you know, you remember in parts of Central Park you can watch birds, bird watchers. So he's in there bird watching, a white woman, a liberal white woman, okay? She's there with a dog, unleashed, even those big signs that says you shouldn't do that. All he did was say you should leash your dog. But she goes berserk. Now, this is typical. She goes berserk. Instead of calling up to 911 and saying, there's a man I'm afraid of, she says there's an African-American man. Because she knows that's how they would read it, as a threat. That's not atypical.
Well, you know, that was sort of ingrained in the U.S. psyche when those right-wingers showed up at the various steakhouses demanding it reopen, carrying assault rifles.
Right. And they weren't touched. So that's part of what everyone knows.
It's so striking.
No, you're right. And that's part of what I think the change with these protests, that is people are starting to recognize that when someone says there's racism, what it means, and the criminal justice system is corrupt, people are waking up to it. Because a lot of the lawyers, a lot of the people come on these TV shows, they try to read the law like it applies to everyone equally when it never has. So, you know, a black lawyer will say, that's not how it works. If you're black, they'll throw 20 charges at you knowing that they can plea bargain to throw you in jail. If you're white, you may not even get charged. But even if you get charged, they'll work something out. And if you're a cop, it's hard to get charged at all and then convicted.
I think it's a little more complicated because if you're white and they don't like you, and if you talk back to them, or if you deny the charges, they may throw the book at you. They don't want to have trials. The whole system
right, but
is rigged.
I agree with you, but that's the exception that proves the point. I mean, a black worker can sit there in their car and doing nothing.
Right.
You know, the thing about the Floyd thing, most people forget, he was sitting in the car. He waited for the police to come after the store owner called about supposedly a counterfeit $20 bill. He didn't run away. He just sat there waiting for them. They dragged him out of his car. They had their gun drawn. That's the difference. White guy that would have went up to his door and said, okay, what's going on? What happened? But one point I do want to talk about, I don't know how much time we have, is this whole campaign against Antifa, the anti-fascist group, which I think the left needs to start speaking up about. From day one, I knew this was fraudulent. From day one, I knew this was a scam by the right and by the police and the president and them. Antifa is a group that stands against fascism, stands against the white nationalists. Every place they've been, including Charlottesville a couple years ago, they were there trying to protect people who were being under attack by the white nationalists and neo-Nazis. Their method is to stand firm, use whatever tactics against the racist type elements. They don't go around attacking the black community centers, Native Americans. I'm not saying they wouldn't attack a police station like everyone else, but this little smear campaign on the left radicals, I've always considered them, these were agent provocateurs involved, I've seen it before with police agents, FBI agents, and then it's come out, the FBI even admitted in D.C., it was white nationalists on the websites, dark web, pretending to be Antifa to cause some of this violence. But, you know, the mainstream media doesn't really talk about it because they want to put out this idea there's the left and there's the right. But I hope more radicals will stand up and defend Antifa myself. I think it's important.
This is Cable Radio 90.7 FM, Bill Resnick. I'm talking to Malik Mia. He's a longtime socialist activist, revolutionary, union activist. He now writes a good deal, including two articles in Green Left Weekly that I recommend. And he's going to be on a webinar in Australia. But you can listen to it at 8 p.m. When is it?
Saturday night.
Malik, one final thing, sort of outline what can be done about police violence. But, of course, police violence is not some isolated part of the United States, some aberration. It's serving various interests. And we're not going to stop police violence just by doing some trainings or community relations work with them or trying to explain how to be nice to people or even kneeling down now at these demonstrations by police chiefs, which is completely it's a theatrical trick. You know, they may be very unhappy about the violence, and not just the violence, of course, of the protests themselves and the overtime they have to pay and how they ever deal with that. Anyway, they're trying to cool things down. But that's not the way anything is going to happen. What do you see as the way of curbing the police violence and bringing some measure of social justice to this country?
Yes, this is a big topic, though. I'm actually going to write an article probably in the next week or two about it, because there's a lot of discussion about police reforms and how to control the police, including the role of the so-called police unions, which I don't consider unions, but... The problem with reforms is that you have to first explain what is the purpose of the police. The purpose of the police is not to protect and serve working class people or black people. It's to protect and serve the interests of the rulers of any city or state or the government, including their property, their business. They don't go to protests of labor strikes or struggles to be there as neutral. They're there to enforce whatever the employer wants. That's why in the black community, it's always been viewed as occupying force, like an invading army. That's not new. That's already the view. It's been the view for, you know, hundreds of years. So the only way to deal with the reforms is that, one, you got to arrest people and prosecute them, like the main demand. Some police have to suffer. They have to change the law. Right now, for the last 40 or more years, all the cops have to say is that I felt fear for my life, and then it's justified homicide. Or justifiable shootings. You don't have to prove anything else. You can just say that, because the laws basically say you have to prove there was intent, and they just have to see why I feared for my life. So that has to go. But the most important one, as far as the black community, in my view, is they got to disinvest money going into the police force. The police force get all the money they want. They can get tanks from the government, heavy armory. That needs to end. And you need community control. And what does that mean? I'm not talking about just independent review boards. I'm talking about a review board that has the right to oversee the police in the community, that can prosecute them with an outside prosecutor, not local district attorney. And I would make the additional demand that the people who serve in the community live in the community. You can't be coming in from the outside. You have to live there so you go through the same conditions that the people. Now, if you can move in that direction, you can make some progress, none of which they will do, but it could prove them. A minimal demand is that they also, when a cop gets quit or fired, they have a national database so people know who they are. Right now, you can be fired in Ferguson and go up to Chicago and get a job. There's no way to track bad cops, as they call them, and they just get hired in another place. So those are some of the demands that you would make, but I think the most important one is community control over the police force with an independent review board, independent prosecutors that are not part of the DA system, and then you could begin to make some changes. The likelihood of that happening is little because of what the role of the police is, but it is a legitimate demand.
Malik, I think we have to end now. You suggested in the interview that, in fact, power relations have to change. We have to have a very, very different way of arranging our economy so that everybody, in fact,
and live a decent life, that so many people are not pushed to the bottom and trapped there and policed there. You pointed out the protests are white and black, and lots of whites are risking themselves and protecting and seeking to protect. It seems to me that, and you suggested that it's a sort of, in some ways, an incipient class struggle of people on the bottom. It seems to me that the police will be changed when, in fact, that kind of struggle eventuates in a very new sort of way of governance of the economy and state. I'm sure you agree. We'll have to talk about that again. Malik, you get the last word, though.
Well, yeah, my last point is I think a new leadership is trying to emerge through these struggles. And the leadership, not just black, but whites and others, who recognize that the electoral system is not the solution to these problems, you have to fight and you have to go to the streets. It's noticeable that most elected officials are on the sidelines, including black Democrats, and they say, yes, I support it, but they have no strategy, they have no plan. It's the new leaders on the streets that are leading the way. That's why I feel positive about this whole movement, because it's not electoralist, and it recognizes the whole system is the problem and needs to change. How it changes, okay, that's up to, you know, time. But the fact that no one is waiting on the politicians, waiting on this current system to fix itself, to me, is the seeds for future revolt.
Malik Mia, thanks so much for talking to us. Keep up the good work. Look forward to your next article.
Okay. Take care. Bye.
Bye.
Out on the streets of Mary, jolly old Rome. Can't get me out unless you use a shoehorn. Eve of destruction, but you still talking free trade. You give me lemons and I make lemons.
So I pray, though I'm tired. Each one you save, easy to save it when you don't need a dang thing. Talking about Jesus, but you treat people dead and wrong. Looking for answers, but you singing the same song. Your economics, well, they sure need a change. You know damn well them CEOs need no raise. Freedom and justice, well, they ain't your plaything. Prop up your puppets and you kill the real king.
I pray. I'm tired, so tired. This can't wait. So we fight. That
was a bit of Mavis Staples singing Fight. And before that, Malik Mia and Bill Resnick discussing the recent uprisings, the importance of health issues and unemployment, as well as racism in generating widespread action, the problems with most police reforms, the actual purpose of police to protect property, the need to defund police and provide community control, and the power of mass mobilization. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, your volunteer-powered community radio station. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle. We also heard Malik Mia pointing out the recent vilification of anti-fascist leftists, or Antifa, and the need for other leftists to speak out in their defense. For more about the role of anti-fascism and fascism in current events, we turn to Joe Clement, talking with Shane Burley. Shane Burley is the author of the book Fascism Today, What It Is and How to End It, and also writes for Jacobin, Waging Nonviolence, Truth Out, and recently the NBC News Online op-ed column.
Thanks, Fran. I'm joined today by Shane Burley.
Shane Burley is author of the book Fascism Today, What It Is and How to End It. He's an anti-fascist activist, a filmmaker, scholar, and journalist, writing articles for numerous publications, including Jacobin Magazine, Waging Nonviolence, and most recently, Truth Out and NBC News. You can find a full bibliography of that and his other work at shaneburley.org. Today we're going to talk about some of the context and conspiracy theories surrounding the recent wave of mass uprisings against police brutality and white supremacy, but also the president's threat to declare Antifa a terrorist organization. Thanks for coming on the Old Mole today, Shane Burley.
Thanks for having me.
Shane, we've seen a week of some of the most massive national protests in the last 50 years. Many of them have been relatively peaceful, though the first few nights and several since were marked by what you and your NBC News op-ed describe as aggressive tactics, including burning down an empty police precinct in Minneapolis and lesser acts of vandalism in several cities. There's been a tendency by the media, the government, and even many protesters to ascribe these extreme actions to quote-unquote outside agitators. We'll talk about how this has fell on anti-fascists later. First, could you tell us the history of this rhetorical strategy when it comes to these mass uprisings and why more recently at least a few people, if not more, are pivoting to white nationalists as the outside agitators, citing a desire to stoke a second civil war called the Boogaloo? What are the dangers of the white nationalists realizing it, and what does this have to do with the protests?
So I guess first, like you mentioned, basically Boogaloo means the second civil war. This is a term that emerged online in message board culture, and it's essentially a group of far-right people who want to see a sort of revolt against the state, and they do it for not left-wing reasons, these are right-wing people, but they see moments of conflict, particularly of racial conflict, at the moment that they can intervene in and help to push it. Some people are identifying as white nationalists in that. A lot of people aren't, and actually they'll even call themselves anti-racist. What they mean by that is not the same thing as the left means, but what they're coming in is actually, in some places, trying to join the protest in a way of pushing it into conflict with police. There's also white nationalists that are coming in, and they're approaching it a couple different ways. Some are joining these kind of militia type vigilante groups to quote unquote protect the city. We're seeing like Proud Boys and stuff doing that. And then on the other side, there is some instances of white nationalists actually trying to urge people into violent action, sort of agent provocateurs. I would really, really hesitate to say that that's a real serious presence. But when it comes to the point of outside agitators, this has a really, really long history. The rhetorical strategy of outside agitators has a few directions. The point is that when people see a protest action, whatever the protest action is escalating in some way, people in power oftentimes will accuse it of being done by quote-unquote outside agitators, meaning these are people not from the community of which the revolt is happening, but are coming in for cynical reasons. Maybe it's political reasons. Maybe it's, you know, they're going to get money from it. Maybe they'll accuse them of being nihilistic or hedonistic. But the point is that what they're doing is framing these acts of revolt as not actually organic to the community. And this has happened for, I mean, hey, there's a decades-long history in the U.S., but honestly, this is a hundreds of year-long strategy of trying to isolate and separate protesters from each other. So the outside agitators is often what you'll hear during union campaigns. Union organizers are called outside agitators, basically. They're coming in and they're stirring up, quote-unquote, good workers, fomenting discontent for their own purposes. This is the rhetoric that was used around the civil rights movement, that people are coming down and taking the good, quote-unquote, good black people in the South and putting these pernicious political even worse, communist ideas into their heads. This has a couple things. I mean, on the one hand, it suggests that the protesters, the people in these protest movements, can't think for themselves and aren't coming up with their ideas on their own. Sometimes it leans into anti-Semitic conspiracy theories where there's a them out there orchestrating this as a cabal, maybe a George Soros type. But the point is that what this is meant to do is discredit these turns in protests, which are incredibly aggressive. So I wrote about these as aggressive protest tactics. And a lot of people feel like that's euphemistic because we're talking about riots here and looting. And I don't think anyone should ignore that that's actually happening. But what people need to understand is that those sorts of protest tactics have a really long history. In fact, they have a much longer history than a lot of the quote-unquote peaceful protest tactics that we know. So historically, riots have gone back for seriously centuries and have been part of these movements to kind of push back on power and see big revolts. So in our more recent history, the labor movement was filled with riots and strikes at the same time. The civil rights movement, though we kind of remember the peaceful marches, it actually were urban insurrections all over the place where those kind of protest actions happen. Whether or not you like it, whether or not you think it's right, those actually are an organic part of protest movement. And so what we do when we talk about it being outside agitators is we try and separate the organic nature from that and talk about what's legitimate and what's illegitimate. And that's completely ahistorical, and it takes the agency away from the people that are doing it and how they're actually approaching that.
That starts to get into what my next question was going to be about, like what happens to the legitimacy of the protest when the outside agitator is credited with organizing, or in this case, derailing them. But what do you think is still useful about conversations about strategic or non-strategic action, and how this reflects or doesn't reflect the dichotomy of the good versus bad protester?
Organizers always have strong questions and critiques and disagreements about strategies and tactics and protest movements and organizing. There's a rhetoric of the good protester versus the bad protester. So the good protester follows the rules, engages peacefully, and that's really an important word here. They are peaceful protesters versus the bad protesters who break those rules. Maybe they engage autonomously, maybe they do things like property destruction, or they're fighting with people, or they're doing all kinds of things that are really, really kind of out there in terms of kind of our social civil code. The problem with this is that when you divide those things, it creates a dichotomy that doesn't actually exist inside protest movements organically. It doesn't exist in the rest of the world organically. So in different times and places, people, you know, engaging in really kind of rambunctious yelling and taking the streets, sometimes people accuse that of being violent. Other times, things like property destruction aren't really seen as violent when, like, fighting with actual people is seen as violent. And the problem is that those values are a shifting target and usually influenced by people in power. And what they're almost always done is to separate the two crowds of people. And in reality, protest movements are successful by the large ability they are to bring people together. And so I think that when people are thinking about how those movements kind of work, they should think a little bit more about how to bring people into ideas, how to bring people into strategies, how to grow those and meet goals to achieve change, rather than trying to single out, oh, that person, if they did something I didn't like, therefore they're an outside agitator, therefore they're not actually a part of this movement any longer.
Can't that sometimes, though, be the tact of concern is that certain kinds of extreme actions will scare people away?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that that's a really important thing that people should take absolutely seriously. And I also don't think that just because people are discontented with the good protest or bad protester rhetoric doesn't mean that critiques over strategies and arguments and choosing a direction and trying to go with it, those are just normal parts of organizing and being involved in activism, whether it's a labor movement or it's a movement against police violence or whatever it is. I think those are absolutely normal parts of it. I think instead it's how are you going to let people outside of your movement define who's on the inside and who's on the outside, and how are you going to find a way to bring larger swaths of people in into an effective social movement?
Well, speaking of people on the outside defining who's on the inside and outside, we've talked on the Old Mole before about Trump's allusions to labeling Antifa a terrorist organization. And in this last week, in addition to threatening to send the army, Trump said his administration would be seeking to define Antifa as a terrorist organization. Why hasn't this gone away? In a recent op-ed for NBC News, you described this as having more political consequences than legal ones, but also said that this could affect how other laws are enforced. Has anything changed about the way that law enforcement officers can target Antifa and other leftists to explain why they're doubling down on this incoherent idea? Or is the main threat from galvanizing fascists in society to take extra legal action?
The fact that it will influence extra-legal, extrajudicial violence is absolutely real. When you trump up the language of terrorism, it actually leads people to take vigilante action, and we've seen that in acts of leftist protesters all across the country, and that's especially important now when we're talking about mass leftist demonstrations with an anti-racist character, and then, you know, reactionary white folks that we're seeing in videos of attacking people with swords or bringing out crossbows or things like that. So all of that is very real threat. So Trump tweeting out that anti-fascists or Antifa, however he defines it, are now terrorists, doesn't mean that they now have a new legal distinction. There is no real statute or mechanism to make a organization in the U.S. a terrorist organization, particularly one like that, which is actually a broad-based social movement, not just one single organization. So there are Antifa organizations, meaning militant anti-fascist organizations that, you know, have organizational rules and members and however they define themselves. But they're not one organization all across the country or across the world. It's actually a really diffuse social movement that has all kinds of different organizations, different approaches, different kinds of folks, different goals, different ways they understand their politics. And so just using the blanket brush, you really have no mechanism to do that. The other thing about it is he's using the term Antifa for whatever he doesn't like. So in this case, he's talking about militant anti-racist protesters, and he's saying that they are Antifa. Well, there's really no evidence at all that anti-fascist organizations or organizers are behind the militant aspects of protests. I did another article, and one organizer pointed out that if there is any role for those anti-fascist organizations at these protests, they have no privileged role. They're basically just part of the rank and file of people who are politically mobilized. But what Trump is doing is he's playing on words that his base knows. They know Antifa. They know that Antifa. What they think they know about Antifa is that it attacks conservatives, because that is what the kind of right-wing online media sphere has said about it. And so what he can do is basically signal to Antifa, say, hey, I'm doing something about this problem that my base is really angry about, which is basically protesters in the streets, and I'm going to blame Antifa for it, and I'm going to kind of stoke that. And that actually shows him as a law and order president in a time of social upheaval, and that's going to play really big with the far-right parts of his base. But again, he's talking about a diffuse group of social movements all across the country. He's not talking about an organization. He's not accurately describing it. All that being said, this shouldn't be taken lightly, because there's a lot of latitude that law enforcement, particularly at the federal level, has in how they're going to kind of enforce laws, how they're going to prosecute people. And if they start feeling like terrorism is what's happening here, we're talking more deep investigations, budgets being shifted, grand juries, wiretapping. We're talking about more aggressive crowd control measures when police believe that terrorism is taking place. There's all kinds of things that can actually start to happen. And I think when you start to label it like that, and when you start to shift things around like that, you see energy taken away from where the violence is actually happening, which is white supremacist movements, and shifting over to a broad-based understanding of leftist social movements, which aren't violent for the most part, and aren't actually responsible for any of this.
And that brings us around full circle to how the political establishment has been shooting out of both sides of its mouth lately, both trying to delegitimate the protests overall by ascribing them to outside agitators, but then also trying to play a seemingly legitimate role in protecting the right to protest by protecting the peaceful component of the protest from the outside agitators. And I'm just wondering whether you see that going anywhere, or is it a sign really of their lack of a strategy?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think they have a strategy, it's just not a good one. This is a divide and conquer strategy. You separate one part of the protesters from the other and actually say, well, actually, we're on your side. We're defending you from those people that are hijacking your movement and undermining it. But the bottom line is that the protesters know that Trump is not their friend on this. And actually, the protest movements have only gotten larger. And frankly, for the most part, more kind of peaceful. So they're actually kind of almost like living up to the caricature that Trump is trying to make, or the standards he's trying to set. But frankly, they're just overwhelming it. And he's still attacking them. Police are still attacking protesters. And so it's really undermined the argument that what he's doing is being the ally of peaceful protesters. Because as those protests become even more peaceful and even larger, they're getting beaten up even more by police. And we're seeing videos all across the country of police kneeling on protesters' necks, of you know, shooting them with quote-unquote less lethal rounds, beating them, of arresting reporters, things like that. So I think that whatever strategy they had, it's a losing strategy, except when you think about Trump's base. And this is always going to be a winning strategy when it comes to that real core he's trying to get out to vote in November.
Well, finally, I wanted to ask what you think listeners should know about fighting fascism during this pandemic. Mass gatherings are traditional ways for communities to tap into and indeed exercise power and other energies. And yet common sense about preventing the spread of COVID-19 makes them a big no-no, despite the current disregard of hundreds of thousands of people across the country. What ways have folks found out to protect our communities from fascism and white supremacist terror without exposing them to more risk in terms of this virus than is necessary?
Yeah, like you said, we're seeing people engage in breathing mass action and take that as a priority. So I think a lot of people are kind of risking it, quote unquote, but and trying to take, you know, protective measures within that. Seeing that the fight for Black lives is most important right now. What's happened with the far right is a couple of things. First off, they try to exploit any crisis to grow, whether it's the pandemic or this recent one. So people need to be aware that they're actually trying to mobilize along these lines, and they tend to be relatively successful, particularly when an economic crisis comes in, which is what we're heading into right now. So I think people need to be vigilant. While they're focusing on police violence, which is directly correlated with white supremacist violence, they shouldn't ignore the insurrectionary white supremacist organizations as well, which are also very capable of violence on the streets. One thing that's happening is that the far right is re-platforming. So for a couple of years since Charlottesville in 2017, they've been kicked off a lot of their social media platforms, a lot of the funding platforms, a lot of the publishing platforms. But over recent months, over the last 6 months, they've actually started to find ways kind of back onto them. And that's especially important when people are kind of sitting in front of social media more and sitting on the computers more because of the pandemic, they're at home more. And so I think anti-fascists are focusing really heavily on trying to get people off those platforms, expose those organizations and those organizers. And so that's the way people have really focused in on how to do that work. But I think also part of it ties to what is it going to take to fight fascists. It's the same thing that's going to take to have a vibrant community. And right now, what people really need is support. They're going to need support for the coming economic crisis and the fallout from this health crisis. So things like when people aren't able to pay their rent and evictions begin again, when people are losing their jobs, when people are having their wages cut, things like that. All of that kind of support is really important. One of the things that fascists do is they try and exploit weak areas of the left, or areas of the left where the left promised something and could not deliver. And so I think the most important thing is to be developing really strong community bonds, really strong support systems, and really kind of tangible tools for how to meet the needs that people are going to have in their lives. And we are going to have a lot of crisis coming up in the next couple of years. And we really are going to have to ask ourselves, what does it take to continue having a vibrant movement and meet that kind of promise? That's going to be different in every situation. But no matter what, I think we should talk more and more about how to build community when we're not always in the same room. What do those expectations look like? How do we do it? But I think people have discovered a lot of those tools amidst COVID-19, and I think people are getting a little bit more comfortable. And once we're able to do that at a distance, I think we're able to do it more permanently and see more action.
Well, you'll be able to find more community resources and connections through your community radio station, KBOO. Thanks, Shane Burley, for coming on the Old Mole today to share some more context about the uprisings, the demonization of Antifa. You can find more of Shane's work at shaneburley.org.
This has been Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking with Shane Burley, author of Fascism Today, What It Is and How to End It.
Thanks again, Shane.
Thanks a lot for having me.
That was a bit of Alligator Boogaloo by Lou Donaldson. And before that, Joe Clement and Shane Burley talking about the recent uprisings against police brutality and white supremacy. They considered the pernicious attempts to delegitimate the movement with tales of outside agitators and with myths about Antifa. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on your community radio station, KBOO Portland, and I'm your host today, Fran Michelle. Shane Burley also pointed out that what it takes to fight fascism is also what it takes to have a vibrant community. For more on the better world that all this may make possible, we turn to Norm Diamond.
This is Norm Diamond with another episode of Another World is Possible. In the last episode, we looked at a mid-19th century effort to establish an alternative community through the eyes of what amounted to a feminist critique of the tension between idealism and practicality. People involved not only thought that very much better social arrangements were possible, they acted on their beliefs. But what enabled them to see the potential that underlies every society, including our own, the reality that fundamental change could make things vastly better? This is a different question from the mere expression of outrage. Outrage can happen in many situations, under many conditions. Outrage, of course, has in mind that something better is possible, but not necessarily the possibility of fundamental change. The differences between advocating for better training or more restraints on the police, for instance, or realizing that policing itself would be basically different in a society founded on racial and economic equity, available social services, meaningful work for all, and fully democratic control. The distinction is crucial in this time of political upsurge. It underlies our choice of objectives in our protests. Will this time be like 2008, when capitalism clearly failed, but protesters put forward no alternative vision? Or will we be able to spread the ideas and the actions that another fundamentally different world is possible? Today, we begin to explore some of the factors that enable that deeper realization in this episode of Another World is Possible. That was our theme music for Another World is Possible. It's taken from The Coup, The Guillotine. Every society presents itself to its members as if it's the best or the only one that could exist. You remember that famous phrase of the 1980s, Tina, there is no alternative. Whether that's in terms of the level of technology, the need to control conflicting groups within or protect people from outside threats, the ability to provide material goods or spiritual benefits, etc. How that happens varies from one type of society to another, whether it's the state as the main promoter of legitimacy, it could be a dominant religious institution, or even commercial enterprises. Revolutionary societies, whether self-proclaimed or genuine, make for interesting examples, ones we'll explore in later episodes. So even if not everyone always believes the message, dominant institutions promote and infuse basic elements of the status quo, dulling the sense of alternatives. So the question is, when can that dulling be overcome? What enables an alternative vision? Under what conditions are people able to resist the conservative message they get from whatever society and see the potential for something much better? In other words, what enables this key aspect of resistance? This question is at the root of dilemmas faced by organizers. When and through what experiences are people open to new political perspectives, not only to a sense of outrage, but to a basic questioning of what exists? Movements and groups have often foundered because of wrong answers or by not even asking the question. An example would be a kind of voluntarism that assumes enthusiasm and will by organizers. These alone can overcome the conditions in people's lives that pull them in a conservative direction. So again, under what kinds of conditions are people open to visions at odds with the status quo? How to decide which groups, situated where in the society, might be most receptive? This is a large question, which we'll explore in multiple episodes of Another World is Possible. For now, thinking back to that mid-19th century utopian effort from our last episode, a huge part of the answer was the disruption caused by the expansion of market relations. Family farms that had been nearly self-sufficient, except for the need to buy salt and one or two other products, were forced into the money economy. Relations within the family that had been based on equal contributions of household well-being now were skewed according to who produced saleable goods and took them to market. In other words, who generated the cash. Young women were shipped out to work in early factories. America's first industrial proletariat, at first in utopian settings with schooling and cultural events and chaperones, all of which quickly deteriorated into dystopian squalor, immiseration, and exploitation. That's a history we'll also explore in a future episode through a story by Herman Melville, The Maids of Tartarus. But no wonder the efforts to create alternatives took such explicitly gendered forms. This intrusion and disruption by the market was not somehow a natural progression, whatever that would mean, perhaps traveling merchants bringing pretty bonnets and newfangled kitchenware. Rather, it was the consequence of deliberate government policy, both raising taxes and insisting on new innovation that they be paid in cash. This, at the same time, governments were building dams to provide power for new industries, flooding what had been productive farmland, and blocking fish runs that had provided livelihoods. This expansion of the market, at precisely the time it happened, in precisely the places where it did, and among precisely the people it most affected, was at the root not only of multiple utopian efforts, but of the creation of new religions, Mormonism and Jehovah's Witnesses among them. This change in their lives in a short amount of time meant that the old explanations people had for themselves, the ways they made sense of the world, no longer corresponded to their new reality. They not only were open to new perspectives, they had direct experience in their own lives that different ways of organizing society are possible. People's openness to fundamental alternatives, then, is not simply a function of oppression, as in the worse things get, the more ready people will be to see alternatives. That's simply not true. That openness, rather, is based on concrete factors in people's lives that challenge what used to make sense to them. We'll talk more about those factors and how organizers relate to them, as well as about utopian and dystopian alternatives in future episodes of Another World is Possible. This has been Norm Diamond for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO FM.
Hey, you! We got your war! We're at the gates! We're at your door! Hey, you! We got your war! We're at the gates! We're at your door! We got the guillotine! We got the guillotine! You better run! We got the guillotine!
We wanna thank you for flying with us. We know you could've stayed home, just cried and cussed. May all your guns go off if it's time to bust. May all their tanks have time to rust. They got the armies turning bullets into gold. They got the hookers turning tricks into cold. And every time the police kicks in the dough, an angel gas breaks, dips in the O. And even if a D-boy flips in my O, look in the sky, wait for missiles to show. It's finna blow, cause they got the TV, we got the truth. They own the judges and we got the proof. We got hella people, they got helicopters. They got the bombs and we got the
we got the guillotine. We got the guillotine, you better run. We got the guillotine. We got the guillotine, you better run. We got the guillotine. We got the guillotine, you better run.
Tell the boss to call police to escort them. You don't ride out them lies, you just quote them. Get offline, plug into this modem. No, you can't outvote them, the rules are still go. If you press the ear to the turf that is stolen, you can hear the sound of limitations exploding. Please, sir, may we have another portion with children of the beast that dodge the abortion. Neck plate firm between the floor and the portion. With caution, we're coming for your head. So call the feds and get files to shred. Every textbook read said bring you the bread. But guess what, we got you instead.
We got the guillotine.
That was Norm Diamond with Another World is Possible, followed by more of that segment's theme song, Boots Riley and the Coups, We Got the Guillotine. This has been the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I've been your host today, Fran Michelle. Thanks to Moles, Norm Diamond, Bill Resnick, and Joe Clement, and thanks to their guests today, Malik Mia and Shane Burley. Thanks also to the fabulous staff of KBOO who've been protecting volunteers' health and Portland's access to information. Please join or donate at kboo.fm and give as generously as you can to maintain the community resource of community radio here at KBOO Portland. The Old Mole will be back next week with more news, views, and interviews about defunding the police, enhancing and endangering community health, and preserving your civil rights to protest.